RadioInfluence.com.
Well, ho, 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 and yes, that will come into play in a little bit. It is our newest edition of We've Seen That. I am TJ Reeves. He is the famous Jay. How you feeling? Are you in the holiday spirit at the time that we are taping?
I am ready to talk about my favorite Christmas movie.
Oh, you are?
Yes, sir.
But what, do you have a list, and are you checking it twice?
Yes. In this particular case, I guess it's got like four sequels, so I could have checked it.
You could have checked it four times, yes, when we figured that out. But I'm trying to determine if you've been naughty or nice for the holiday season, because we're ready to have some fun on this edition of the show. And should we let the audience in on exactly what we're going to be talking about?
We are talking about the 1988 classic Die Hard starring Bruce Willis.
And we're putting it out there right now. This is a Christmas movie. Here you go. Here's the actual trailer. Here you go.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A.
California.
Is Daddy coming home with you?
Well, we'll see what Santa and Mommy can do, okay?
A New York cop, John McClane, has come to see his wife.
I missed you.
Instead, he's going to have to save her.
Sit down.
Within this skyscraper high above the city, 12 terrorists have declared war.
They're about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power.
They're as brilliant.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in your vault.
As they are ruthless.
And I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay. We do it the hard way.
Now, the last thing McClane wants.
Think, damn it, think.
Is to be a hero.
Where's Holly?
Hey, Tucker!
Where?
But he doesn't have a choice.
What does he think he's doing?
Job.
They have already killed one hostage.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
There you go, I sound like I'm wearing a pizza!
He's inside? Who is he? Who are you then? You are most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, wrong guess, huh? Would you like to go for double jeopardy?
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother...
You just destroyed a building.
And I am in charge of this situation.
Well, I got some bad news for you. From up here, that look like you're in charge of Jack.
He is alone, he is tired, and he hasn't seen Disney Squad from anybody down here.
Hey, pal, how you feeling?
No things being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
I want blood.
And you have it.
Only John can drive somebody that crazy.
He's an easy guy to like.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis. Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
There you have it. Die Hard starring Bruce Willis. It was released on July 15th, 1988.
I mean, that's the first thing I got to laugh at. It's a Christmas movie, but they released it in July. I didn't remember that.
Correct. Not only that, you know, we think of this as being one of the just the biggest hits of our lifetime. But it came out in limited release July 15th. It didn't go wide until July 22nd. And it when it opened, obviously, it opened to number 16. It made $601,000 its first weekend. It would go on to gross $83 million in the U.S., an additional $57 million overseas for a worldwide total of $140.7 million for Die Hard. And this was kind of Bruce Willis's, you know, first foray into big movies. He was at the time making the show Moonlighting with Cybill Shepherd. And this was kind of his first big hit and first big blockbuster action type movie. He had previously appeared in Blind Date starring Kim Basinger. And then following that, he was in a movie called Sunset. Not sure if you're familiar with that one. It had James Garner.
No, nope,
it was made by Blake Edwards.
I think he had
Die Hard. And his next big movie after Die Hard was Look Who's Talking. So this was kind of the beginning of the Bruce Willis phase for us. And let's talk, just throw a few stats out for the our listeners here, for the box office on the series of Die Hard, which one do you think made the most?
I'm thinking the sequel would have done the best, because then people were so anticipating, and again, it was a Christmas setting in the second. I got to go the second one. The second one right away probably clobbered all the rest, maybe combined.
Yeah, when we go adjusted for ticket price, Die Hard 2 was far and away the best. Die Hard 2, Die Harder, which was in 1990. Then Die Hard with a Vengeance was our second in this series. It came out in 95. The original Die Hard was third. So that's how that looks on the box office. As far as Bruce Willis, what do you think was his highest grossing film?
You mean ever?
Ever for him.
Don't tell me it's the Look Who's Talking movies.
No, that would be number three.
Beyond the Die Hard chain, I can't come up with something right now, although he's been in some various ones as either a villain, a couple of different ones. The Sixth Sense probably comes to mind as the psychiatrist,
The
right?
Sixth Sense is number one.
Yeah.
Armageddon is number two. So he's had a couple of big hits outside the Die Hard franchise. And then we also have the other one that he's really well known for, Pulp Fiction, was number five.
Oh, how about that? That
adjusted for gross, $226 million.
Wow. All right. So, yeah, he was really rocking along. And I know that we should say to the audience here that we're going to dissect this movie and why it works. And we're also going to bring somebody on here that you and I both know. And we'll introduce him a little bit to the audience. Who's in London, a friend of ours, who does a great job writing and is a big sports fan, but I didn't realize to what extent he was a big Die Hard fan, Bruce Willis fan. Paul Stewart is going to join us a little bit later on, and Paul has got some interesting comments about Bruce Willis and him in this role and how it basically launched his film career. I want to go back to what you said with moonlighting, and you're a little younger than I am. We should say that, and we've seen that, although I'm not that old. But I was a big fan of that television series. That was an ABC hit dramatic comedy weekly television series, and it really made Bruce Willis into a star, that series. So my question to you is, did you watch Moonlighting when it was first running on over the air ABC TV? Were you into it?
I did not, but I have seen episodes over the years him playing David Addison. I believe, was he a private eye?
They both were.
The private agency.
Right, they both were private investigators. Right, that was the whole idea.
And it might have been towards the end of the series, the ones I've seen, but it had Mark Harmon was on it.
Right.
Also, so that, like, the ones I've seen, like I said, might have been towards the end of the series. I'm not really sure, but I believe it was one of the things where Cybill Shepherd kind of got to pick between the two of them which one she liked.
Well, and part of it, too, is that Willis began to get bigger and do movies and that kind of thing, and they tried to keep the show going. I remember there was some controversy, too, about whether the show was going to be canceled, going to be brought back. But that's really where Bruce Willis made his claim to fame. He's on the smaller screen, on the little screen on television. And it led to bigger things, obviously. And this was a breakout action movie. So let's go back to July of 88. I'm going to show my age here. I had just graduated from high school, and I did not see Die Hard in the theater. We've joked on, we've seen that before, that this is the time frame. And I know the kids, if we have millennials, if we have 20-somethings, if we have teenagers listening, they have no idea, Jay, what we're about to talk about. But Blockbuster Video with the VHS tapes, you know, go find a video on Friday night or Saturday night at Blockbuster in one of the cases and bring it home and put it in your VCR and watch. That's how I saw Die Hard, like later that summer, whenever they released it early in the fall on a Friday night, a Blockbuster rental. That was me. Did you see Die Hard in the theater? What's the story?
I actually have a little bit of fun trivia. It's the first R-rated movie I ever saw at the theater.
Ever.
My dad had gone to see it, and he convinced my mom that it was okay for me to see it. He took me to see it.
Just gloss over this conversation. Exactly how did that go in the Betzel household, that dad convinced mom that this was, quote, okay to see it, with in terms of all of the violence, all of the violence, all the killing, the bang, shoot 'em up that goes on for like 2+ hours in this movie? How did that conversation go?
Well, you know, it wasn't like there wasn't like a lot of sex or nudity or anything in it, so it was okay. It wasn't anything we hadn't seen before.
Except, of course, when Willis walks in on the couple that's in the one office. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and I probably had my eyes covered a couple of times, but what I was going to say is the people, you know, people that listen to us, they know that I live in Fort Worth and grew up here. And I saw it at the old Hewlin Mall movie theater in this huge THX room on this huge screen. And I remember it so well because it was just like the best movie ever. And I remember telling some of my friends that I'd seen it, and they were all so jealous because there's no way their parents were going to let them see it. And it was just one of those things that, you know, you have certain memories. I can't tell you every movie I saw at every theater, but I remember this one, and I just remember how great it was.
So you
what
only,
an experience was to see on the big screen.
You only saw it, excuse me, the one time in the theater, or did you go back and see it another time with dad or an adult again in the theater? Only once?
Back then, I only did see it that one time. But well, I have seen it since. There's an Alamo Draft House here in the DFW area that will have old movies every now and then they show. And I saw it there, and it was the same thing. But it's just – it's a fun movie to see on the big screen if you have the opportunity. You know, a lot of times, you know, the reason that people listen to shows like ours – is that people have good old day syndrome for when movies like this were out. And, you know, a lot of these theaters will kind of take advantage of it, and they'll have these, you know, one-off screenings of these movies. So if you ever see it, you know, playing near you, I would definitely recommend going to see this. Even if you've seen it 10 times, it's just a different experience to see it on the big screen.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to do that. Cause again, I've now almost 30 years later, have never seen it in the theater. Have only seen it on the VHS or now the DVDs that I have, or being able to watch the reruns. And of course it'll be on TV coming around Christmas time at the time that we're taping. And, you know, it's just interesting because it was in a time frame where the dramatic action movie, the thriller, if you will, that also had humor here and there, because this movie has plenty of humorous little parts, little segments where you go, ha ha. It's not just a morbid, killing, dramatic suspense movie, not unlike Schwarzenegger, you know, shooting up everything in Predator or Commando or whatever, and going knock knock before he blew the door off of whatever. James Bond always seemed to have the funny one-liners and the funny quips when he's in his dramatic action movies. This was kind of the same thing. Yes, it's a bang bang shoot 'em up, as I like to call them, but there's some humor in this movie, Jay.
Yeah, and it's kind of one of those things, you know. When I look back on my lifetime of watching these kind of movies, the first one that kind of set these off for me was the original 48 Hours back in 82.
Right.
It was Eddie Murphy's first movie. Nick Nolte was in it. And it was a serious action movie. It just had a lot of funny parts because Eddie Murphy was so great. You know, and it's the same producers made that made Lethal Weapon and made Die Hard, you know, Joel Silver. And I kind of think that 48 Hours kind of set the tone for all these others. Without 48 Hours and Beverly Hills Cop, you know, we wouldn't have all these, you know, serious action movies
that
just had funny parts in them. And, you know, I'm not comparing these two movies like story wise, but, you know, the thing about that is that they saw something that people liked, you know, and like I'll maybe even go back to Dirty Harry, you know, how serious the Dirty Harry movies were, but he would have some little quips, some lines, the little one liners like, you know, make my day.
Wait, yeah, I was going to say,
do you feel lucky?
Ahead,
or, you know,
make my day. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so I think that lends a lot to this. And this was just kind of, it was the perfect storm. You know, you had these two guys facing off. You had Hans Gruber and John McClane. You know, basically these two guys were going head to head at the top of this skyscraper. You know, and I'm surprised it didn't turn into the Towering Inferno with the way that, you know, they're blowing up stuff in the building and all the stuff, you know, the fact that they're up at the very top and everything. But I mean, it's a fun, entertaining movie. And the fact that they do have Bruce Willis's little, you know, remarks and jokes and stuff, I think, you know, the lightening the mood is what makes the movie so enjoyable, because it could have been, I mean, it's intense enough as it is, but it could have been really hard to watch. It could have been borderline a disaster movie if it didn't have the funny parts. And, you know, we were talking about the cast a minute ago. Let's kind of hit some of the highlights. We've obviously, you know, mentioned that Bruce Willis and Alan Rickman are in it, but we also have Bonnie Bedelia,
yes,
is playing Holly Gennaro.
We got to talk about her at length. We don't have to do it right now, but we got to talk about her at length a little bit later on, and we've seen that. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to kind of casually mention this, that, you know, a lot of people know that you and I are friends from our love of movies, and she is in our movie, Presumed Innocent.
That's right.
She plays Harrison Ford's wife. So if you hadn't seen Presumed Innocent, go ahead and watch that now.
She's arguably got the most famous couple of supporting actress wife roles in movies in the last 25 years, playing John McClane's wife, and then Rusty Savage's wife in Presumed Innocent. That's primarily really what she's known for, at least to us anyway, those two different roles. So it's kind of interesting with Bonnie. But we'll talk more about Bonnie Bedelia. I didn't mean to sidetrack you on the rest of the cast. Go ahead.
No problem. We also have Paul Gleason, who you and I both know from The Breakfast Club. And, of course, we mentioned Eddie Murphy earlier. He was in Trading Places. So Paul Gleason plays Deputy Police Dwayne T. Robinson, who just can't ever really say the right thing. His character is almost kind of there just to make everyone else look better, I think, because anytime he opens his mouth, he says the wrong thing. You agree with me there?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with you there. And I know we'll talk more with Paul Stewart about the different law enforcement officers that are in this movie and why it worked the way that it worked. And it adds to the humor, too. In fact, I quote these kind of movies all the time. My wife and I will walk around, and whenever something's going on at Dawn, or we need the Dawn dishwashing detergent or something like that, we will go Dawn, D-A-W-N, just like Paul Gleason spells it out as Dwayne T. Robinson in Die Hard. So that's good. All right, keep going on the cast. Keep going.
We also have William Atherton, who played Thornburg, who was obviously in this one and Die Hard 2. And he was basically reprising his role as the EPA guy from Ghostbusters.
Yes.
He might be the bigger villain than Hans Gruber, because he's just a horrible person in general. At least Hans Gruber is good for money.
All right. And what else? Anybody else of significance? There's actually a couple more.
Yeah, there's more. We've got Alexander Goodenough, who played Carl, and people would know him from The Money Pit. And then, you know, like the Fort Worth film TV show, Walker, Texas Ranger, Clarence Gilliard Jr. In that with Chuck Norris. He plays Theo in this.
He had been in Top Gun, Gilliard. Did he basically get the Chuck Norris Walker, Texas Ranger in large part because of his role maybe in Die Hard? And it definitely made him famous enough.
It certainly could not have hurt. And then just lastly, I want to touch on the cast real quick. We have one of my all-time favorite action movie actors, Robert Davi, playing Special Agent Johnson, along with Grant Bush, who played Agent Johnson.
Yeah, we'll talk about them a little bit more in a little bit here on We've Seen That. Again, we want to remind the audience that you can follow us on social media at We've Seen That on Twitter, as well as We've Seen That on Facebook. That is the show that you're obviously a part of right now, and we do our best to try to analyze these movies, give you some different fun things that we remember, things that we've seen. Hey, back to Alexander Goodenough, who's no longer with us, obviously, and there's a couple of them. The same with Alan Rickman. We'll talk more about that with Paul Stewart in a little bit when we start talking about British actors. But Goodenough, obviously, was also part of a Harrison Ford movie, speaking of Presumed Innocent. He was part of Witness, an outstanding dramatic thriller. Didn't have the humor. Dramatic thriller with Harrison Ford and Kelly McGillis playing the Amish widow. And the son, Lucas Haas, witnesses a homicide and becomes the important witness in a big case. Goodenough is in that as one of the Amish, and of course known much more as a ballet dancer, as a dancer and as an entertainer. But he's definitely a bad guy in Die Hard, Alexander Goodenough. There's no doubt about that.
Evil.
Yeah.
and he does not like Bruce Willis.
Yes. So we know about all these different things being set into motion. What about, before we get to the conversation with Paul Stewart here that we had, and I want to talk to him some more and cover some more of these different subjects, what about the premise alone of the whole hostage situation and the whole terrorist thing, that we're going to hold the workers in the Nakatomi Plaza hostage for money? Remember in the 1980s, in the time period, this was not, in the United States, this was not really something that we knew about, or it was ever really an issue in the U.S. It was always a foreign problem with hostages. You would go somewhere as an American and maybe be in danger in a foreign country, in a hostile land. But this is a domestic terrorist situation here. The terrorists are from a foreign country, different ones, but they're taking American hostages here and holding them for ransom. What do you make of the premise, Jay Betzel?
Well, and the thing about it is, they obviously, for those who have not seen the movie in a while or just kind of revisiting it again, the kind of the setup of the movie is that Hans Gruber and his group of terrorists, quote unquote, they basically take the hostages of the Christmas party of the Nakatomi building, or the Nakatomi Corporation at the Nakatomi Plaza in Los Angeles. And the idea is that they need to get the FBI to come in to cut the power. They've got this long-term plan. There's a reason they're doing the hostage thing, because they're not technically terrorists, they're really robbers, you know, thieves, because they want the $600 million in bearer bonds that they have in their vault. So the whole terrorist thing is really more of a sideshow to get what they need. And then obviously with the ending plan, according to Hans Gruber, being to blow up the roof with everyone on it so that everyone thinks that he's dead.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. So that's the battle. That's the crux of the movie as we talk more about Die Hard here. All right, are you ready to loop in our man from London, Paul Stewart, as part of our conversation here and continue on with some of his thoughts? He's a hardcore fan of this movie. You want to bring him on We've Seen That?
Yeah, let's go talk to Paul for a minute, and we'll come back afterwards.
Across the pond, across the Atlantic Ocean, on another continent, we spare no expense on We've Seen That, because we're going to London, England, to say hello to Paul Stewart here and welcome him in on Die Hard. Jay Betzel, we know this guy in different forms and fashions. Number one, he is arguably the biggest Tampa Bay Buccaneer football fan outside the continental U.S. Heck, he may be the biggest Tampa Bay Buccaneer fan, period. He's a big-time golfer, which you and I appreciate, Jay. And he also loves Die Hard, Jay Betzel. So
how can you beat that? How can you beat that? Golf and Die Hard.
And both. All right, so, Paul, good to have you. You and I have been talking about potentially getting you on one of our podcasts. Now here you are. And so it is Die Hard. And you were so anxious. You were like rifling off all of these different topics and all of these different things. How many times have you seen Die Hard, by the way, some 30 years later?
I probably have seen this film in the region of 30 to 40 times. To me, I'll watch this film every Christmas because, first of all, it is a Christmas film. So just like A Wonderful Life and Miracle on 34th Street, Die Hard is a film to watch at Christmas.
Yeah. Well, Betzel and I both agree on that. The famous Jay loves you for that. Now, this is interesting, Jay, because I know Paul wants to talk about Alan Rickman as the villain, as Hans Gruber. The terrorist here, because he's a now late famed British actor, theater and on the big screen. So what about Alan Rickman in this role here as Hans, as the arch enemy of John McClane?
Let me say, this is one of like the greatest villains ever, you know, in my mind. And a lot of it has to do with the actor that played it. You know, I mean, I thought he was really cool, and it's kind of funny, obviously. You know, it's basically John McClane's the good guy and Hans Gruber's the bad guy. But sometimes you're kind of rooting for Hans Gruber just because he's pretty cool.
Paul, what about it? What about Alan Rickman in this role? I know you got some different thoughts.
Well, I think it was quite an amazing story how he came to get the role in the first place, because he'd never really done any films of any kind. He'd always been a sort of theatre and Shakespearean actor. And he came out to Hollywood, and within a sort of couple of weeks of arriving in L.A., he was offered the part of Hans Gruber. And he was originally said, I'm not going to do this. Being a terrorist isn't sort of my line of work. And people were saying to him, look, if you get offered a film like this, the minute you arrive in L.A., you take it. And Jay's right. He gave a fantastic performance as a bad guy. He then went on, of course, to be the Sheriff of Nottingham in Kevin Costner's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where he was equally magnificently psychotic with one-liners everywhere. And I've always thought if you could combine those two roles, you could have had the greatest James Bond villain of all time.
Maybe missed his calling on that one. We do love some of the different lines. In fact, Paul even subject titled an email to me with the line about Mr. Takagi. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Takagi will not be joining us for the rest of his life. I mean, that one scene where Rickman's interrogating him for the passcodes, it's so beautifully put together. You know, it shows that he's wonderfully in control, but he's not in control because he shoots the guy. Then you've got the other two terrorists exchanging money because they've had a bet on whether he'd give up the password or not. It's a beautiful scene. And it sets
and all
the
fairness,
tone for how this
Hans
film
did give Takagi the chance to live. He didn't just kill him in cold blood. He didn't give him the option. You know?
Well, you know, but then he went full-on terrorist after that. But that's also the part of the movie, of the film, where you understand Hans means business, and this is not just fun and games, and you really begin to understand they're planning on killing all of the hostages at the end, too. That's their plan. These are not just thieves. These are killers, and he demonstrates, I am a killer. I am willing to kill here.
Well, he also knew that, you know, he had Clarence Gilliard who could break the codes. You know, so it wasn't like he had to torture Takagi because he already had his backup plan.
Well, they were trying to save some time or do something else. And, of course, there's a couple of other great exchanges where he's rattling off the ransom demands to Deputy Chief Robinson and anybody else that's listening. And Alexander Goodenough is looking at him, and Heinrich, I think it is, and he's looking at him and saying, "What?" And Hans Gruber says back to him, "I read about them in Time magazine." And he keeps going on and on with all the different groups that he wants released, right?
I think Rickman is fantastic in it. I mean, a lot of modern people will know him for his parts in the Harry Potter films where he played Professor Snape, and he had some other film roles. But I think these two performances, the one he gives as Gruber, the one he gives as Sheriff of Nottingham, that is what people will remember Rickman for, because after all, who everybody loves a really good bad guy.
Yeah, well, and of course, near the end, he's in the vault with Bonnie Bedelia, with Mrs. McLean, and or in this case Holly Gennaro, and she says at the end of this something like this, right, Jay Betzel? She says something like, "At the end of this, you're only a common thief," or something like that. And
I'm an exceptional thief.
And he just races across the floor of the vault to get right in her face with that famous line. Paul Stewart, what about that? About that famous line, "I'm an exceptional thief."
I think he's just fantastic. I mean, that's the level that he takes this film. I mean, we've had some fantastic, adventure films in the late 80s with some good bad guys. But, I mean, Rickman bringing the British acting to a European character, he just takes it to that next level that we hadn't seen in some of the other great adventure films of the 80s. And I think this is why it makes him so good. And, I mean, Empire magazine, of course, did this thing in 2006 where they gave up their 20 best film characters, and both Hans Gruber and John McClane made it into that top 20.
Yeah, it's only fitting. Okay, so again, we've got Paul Stewart joining us on this edition of We've Seen That from England. Hey, I'm curious, and I know we're going back in time, but in 1988, in the late 80s, were these movies a big deal in England? Were they popular in the theaters? What do you remember about at the time? They were obviously a big deal in the United States. What about in England?
Die Hard was a very big film. I mean, we had all these great films. You've got the sort of Commando, the Predator, the Top Gun, all these great American adventure type films coming over. I remember going to see Die Hard when it came out, and it was a big film to go and see, and same with the sequels we'll probably come on to. So yes, it was a big thing. I mean, of course, we'll talk about Bruce Willis being a bit of an unknown in terms of big films. He'd only done the sort of moonlighting TV show, so not a lot of people in Britain had really heard of him, but we loved this film from the minute it first came out.
Yeah, and you've got actually the tip on that about how that part worked, where he was doing the very popular television series Moonlighting with Sybil Shepherd, and how did all of this come about that Willis ends up being there, Paul?
Yeah, well, originally, I mean, there were a lot of different actors considered for the role of John McClane. I mean, because it was a book tie-in, there was some kind of contractual agreement. They had to offer the part to Frank Sinatra, which thankfully he turned down. I mean, I'm just trying to picture him singing New York, New York while climbing through one of the ducts. But they also considered Arnold Schwarzenegger, because you always did in that day. You always considered Sylvester Stallone. Apparently Richard Gere was up for the role. I mean, that I really can't picture. It was hard enough taking him seriously in The Jackal with Bruce Willis. But Bruce Willis turned down the role originally because he was filming Moonlighting. Then Sybil Shepherd got pregnant, and they had to have about 11-week hiatus on the filming of Moonlighting, which gave Willis the chance to film Die Hard while taking a break from Moonlighting.
Yeah, how about that? All right, so Jay
Betzel,
go ahead.
One thing back to what I mentioned, don't forget Bruce Willis had already made Blind Date, you know, which had him and Kim Basinger, and it was kind of a failure. You know, so it wasn't like it was a thing where, oh, my God, we need to have Bruce Willis. And I had also read that Mel Gibson was the first choice, but that he turned it down because he thought it was too similar to Lethal Weapon, which he had done the year before.
How about that?
So had Mel Gibson been in it, he would have been in two of the greatest movies of all time.
I'm going to hit both of you with something on this. I'm a hardcore Miami Vice guy from the 80s with Don Johnson, Philip Michael Thomas, the whole thing. Bruce Willis was a villain on one of the episodes of Miami Vice. He was playing a mafia, drug-dealing, gun-running type guy down in Miami who's an abusive husband, and they get the wife to turn on him and the whole thing. And I won't spoil how it ends in that scenario, but.
I appreciate the spoiler alert on the Miami Vice, because I definitely am trying to catch up on it now.
Yeah, well, you need to, because I mean that's the old school. Yeah, and so you go back to those days. And Paul Stewart, I get the sense you're also a Miami Vice guy. Do you remember Bruce Willis being the villain on that one individual episode?
And I love that. But again, I mean, yeah, I mean, Bruce Willis, he hadn't been a big star. I mean, and one of the great stories is the original posters for the Die Hard film very much focused on the building and not Bruce Willis. His face was there, but he was not the main part of the poster. Then when the film became a big success, they remade the posters and had Bruce Willis all over it.
Yeah, that's a tribute to him. All right, what else here, Jay Betzel, do we want to query Paul Stewart about from London about Die Hard?
Well, one thing I was just going to throw out is the Agent Johnson and Special Agent Johnson know the other one. What do you think about those guys, Robert Davi and Grandel Bush?
It does make me laugh that this film does seem to feature a bunch of very bad police and FBI officers, because there's no doubt the two FBI guys are just in it for how many guns they can shoot. And Robert Davi, who played the other Johnson, he and Arnie Schwarzenegger were big mates, and apparently Schwarzenegger was really unhappy with the way Davi was portrayed in the film as not coming across as a great character.
But something remember Robert Davi was about the best this one in Raw Deal. Do you remember that one?
Raw Deal, yeah.
Raw Deal with Schwarzenegger. He was probably the coolest one in that movie.
Yeah, he was a great Bond villain in License to Kill as well, one of the more darker Bond films from that era. But something I've always wondered is, you've got Davi, of course, and the two Johnsons in the FBI. You've got this Deputy Dwayne T. Robinson, who's got to be one of the worst chief of police I've ever seen. Now, you guys reviewed Beverly Hills Cop 2 a few weeks ago, which had Chief Lutz, who was one of the worst of all time. What is it? If being a head of the police in Los Angeles means you have to be pretty incompetent to get there.
Southern California law enforcement was suffering. But let's keep one important factor in mind here, boys. I think something is lost on you, Paul Stewart, and maybe not on Jay Betzel, but it sounds like to me in your tone, Paul, this is Christmas Eve. Who's on duty at the LAPD? Who's on duty at the FBI? I mean, that's another reason why Agent Johnson and Special Agent Johnson have an opportunity to come run roughshod, because there's nobody else around on Christmas Eve, and they see an opportunity to come take this situation over and shoot some bad guys. What do you think, Paul?
Good point. You've got me there, TJ.
You like that?
Well, and one thing, too, about Deputy Chief Dwayne T. Robinson is, you know, TJ and I have talked about The Breakfast Club for about as long as we've known each other. And basically, Paul Gleason is basically continuing his role as Principal Vernon, who was one of the worst educators of all time
into
the police department.
Show Dick some respect, please. Yes.
Yeah, the way he treats Judd Nelson's character Bender in Breakfast Club is essentially how he treats the John McClane character in Die Hard.
Yeah, you want a breath mint while he's getting ready to talk to the FBI. Fitting. All right, a couple more moments here with Paul Stewart. What else do you want to say about Die Hard, the original? They went on to make several. I'll just give you the floor on this classic movie. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, something I've always realized, I mean, once you have a big successful film, there was always going to be a sequel. I mean, as Mel Brooks famously said, we'll all be back in Spaceballs 2, The Search for More Money. And Die Hard 2 was very good. 3 was okay, but it had Samuel L. Jackson in it, which gives it a get-out-of-jail-free card, and we'll completely forget anything after that. But, I mean, something that always makes me laugh about Die Hard is there was so many... It spawned its own genre in that when they made Speed, it was, this is Die Hard on a bus. You know, and when they did Air Force One, it was, this is Die Hard on a plane.
With the president
on
the plane. It was always Die Hard
on something. It created its own genre off one film, and I can't think of many other films that could have done that in history.
That's a great point on that. All right, Famous Jay, what else? What else here for Paul Stewart, being a critic in London? Anything else?
I think we've pretty much covered it all.
Yes, we've done well on this. All right, so my question is, because we're still doing this at the time that we're taping, we're doing this pre-Christmas, do you have to sneak off into a separate room to watch this on video, on DVD? Does the family still watch it with you? I know you're going to watch it, Paul, in London before Christmas, but, I mean, does the family watch it with you? Are you going to watch it several times? What's the itinerary?
I think it'll be one of those films that I'll convince my daughter Tanish to watch, because I know she knows I've got her into watching Star Wars films, and she's got me into watching Harry Potter. So the least I can do is introduce her to Die Hard. I mean, you know, how can you not have a chance to watch Alan Rickman be a bad guy like this? That's what Christmas is about.
I love it. I love it. Paul Stewart, thank you for joining us from London and weighing in. I told you I would work you in on a We've Seen That, and we did it for Die Hard. We may come to you again at a later date. I feel so awful, if you can't tell in the sarcastic tone in my voice, that your temperatures are down in the 20s Fahrenheit or the 30s Fahrenheit and you can't golf in England because you keep trying to rub it in on how good a golfer you are, how many club championships you're winning. I feel awful for you that in December right now you can't play golf. I feel terrible.
I think the only thing I can say, and I'll turn the quote off, of course, is yippee-ki-yay.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you, Paul Stewart, for being with us.
Thanks, Paul.
Pleasure, guys.
All right, that was fun hearing from Paul and hearing a different different way of looking at things from the diehard perspective.
Hey, can I tell you something? I've known Paul Stewart for 20-plus years. We've communicated about all things football, American football. We're talking about he's a humongous fan overseas of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, an NFL team that I work for. I never really knew he was that big into this movie until recently when we began, you and I, talking about doing this. We had included him on some other stuff. He is hardcore into this movie, and we'll be watching it around Christmas time like we will be at the time that we're taping here. I never knew that about him. It's fascinating.
No, absolutely. It's kind of funny when you talk to, you know, you know that you and I, we know what we like because this is what we always talk about. But when you have someone else that kind of shares the passion and the vigor, if you will, for this, it's fun to hear that.
Yeah, no doubt. So now, you know, we had that conversation with him. He was talking about how it was received in London and how there became fans of the big movies. What about back in 1988 when this movie first came out? What were the critics saying?
Let's visit Mr. Roger Ebert from the Siskel and Ebert show that everyone knows, that are movie fans anyways.
Right.
He did not like it. He gave it 2 stars. He gave it thumbs down on the show. And he just basically said that it was silly. And it's funny, he kind of echoes what we were saying earlier. He really did not like Paul Gleason's character. He says, and this is the quote, "The filmmakers introduce a gratuitous and unnecessary character, the deputy police chief who doubts the guy on the other end of the radio is really a cop at all. And as nearly as I can tell, he is in the movie only for one purpose, to be consistently wrong at every step of the way and to provide a phony counterpoint to Willis's progress." Very interesting.
But see, you get my point from when we were talking with Paul. That's who's on duty on Christmas Eve. The same with the FBI guys. I mean, when we get to Christmas weekend at the time that we're talking, it becomes a skeleton crew. It becomes less and less competent people. It's more or less who's around, who's available, who may not have as much family, doesn't have family in town. And Deputy Chief Dwayne Robinson apparently is just on duty, and he's not ready for Hans and his guys. So I actually think it works in that regard. It's more realistic that this is the kind of guy that would be on duty, not some super cop that's in command to help solve the situation.
No, I agree. You know, the thing is that all of the police officers, similar to what Paul was saying, is they all show their own level of incompetence. Pretty much John McClane is the only cop who seems like he really knows what he's doing and the only one that I would really like to call if I was in this situation.
Yeah, or the one that you would need. All right, so again, we enjoyed that part of the conversation with Paul Stewart. You and I were talking earlier in the podcast about Bonnie Bedelia. Let's revisit that, shall we, a little bit. She comes off here as Holly Gennaro or Holly McClane, and this is really, I don't think it's wrong to say, her most famous role is she's Bruce Willis's wife in the first two Die Hard movies, right? So what about Bonnie Bedelia?
I agree. Well, are you a Bonnie Bedelia fan?
I was briefly because she was only in a few movies, and that's about it.
Well, I thought she did a good job in this. I mean, and obviously her character in Presumed Innocent is a little different.
Oh,
you know, she's playing a wife, but it's not quite the loving wife that she is in Die Hard, or that she comes to be at the end of Die Hard.
Right. Well, and certainly, again, these are the two most prominent roles for her. And so, you know, it's just You know,
well, yeah, let's not act like she was literally only in these two movies, you know, because she's been in a bunch of movies. Well,
wait, before you look at, okay, because I can look it up too, but before you look at anything, what of note do you remember her being in besides these two movies? And I know you're better at this than I am. I can't really
I know
tell
she
you
she was
anything.
In Heart Like a Wheel, where she played Shirley Muldowney, because that was the first
oh, that's
thing
right.
Saw her
that's
in.
Right. She
and
did.
Then she was also in Fat Man and Little Boy with Paul Newman.
Okay.
Which was a right around. I believe it might have been in between Die Hard and Die Hard 2.
Well, back to Heart Like a Wheel. I mean, Shirley Muldowney is the drag racing queen of the 1970s and 80s, the trailblazer. And I had forgotten until you said that she played that. But again, not an overwhelming box office success. So, you know, again, she acted on the small screen years later, Lifetime television dramas. NBC drama Parenthood for a few years, but I mean, she's Holly McClain, Holly Gennaro from these two movies, right?
Yeah, I will not argue that. That's what I know her from is Die Hard.
I still love the exchange with Hans when Hans says, "What idiot put you in charge?" And she has the great line coming back at him.
She said, "You did when you murdered my boss."
Like that. All right. So what else here as we close things down with Die Hard and Scoop, Paul Stewart agrees with you and with me. This is clearly a Christmas movie. It has got the Christmas setting. They're playing the Christmas songs. Yes, it's a bang, bang, shoot 'em up. No, Santa Claus does not come down a chimney and give the kids presents on Christmas morning. But this is a Christmas movie. We're in agreement, aren't we?
We are 100%. That's why at the very beginning I said we are going to talk about my favorite Christmas movie. There's no argument from my end. This is one of the movies my brothers and I will watch this every year. You know, it'll be an excuse for us to get together. Hey, let's go watch Die Hard or something. So it's a fun movie. It's really entertaining, and obviously, you know, the good guy's going to win. You just don't know how he's going to pull it off because the odds are so insurmountable. And then one thing, it's kind of a little diehard breaking news that happened this week while we were getting ready to do this. There's a thing, it's called the National Film Preservation Act from the Library of Congress.
Okay.
And they select 25 films that are each at least 10 years old and considered to be culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
Okay.
And they pick them to be inducted and preserved. And they do this once a year. And they consider 5,200 titles that are nominated by the public. And this year, Die Hard was amongst those.
So it's one of the ones that now goes into the vault, the famous
archives? It is entered
archives into
the National Film Registry. Yes. And like other movies that got put in this year include Titanic, Field of Dreams, wow. Superman, Mementos. I mean, this is a really big deal for our little Christmas movie that opened in limited release back in 1988. So it's a little fun fact about Die Hard. Breaking Die Hard news here when we've seen that.
Yeah, it certainly launched Bruce Willis into the stratosphere in terms of Hollywood acting as a star. I still remember Bonnie Bedelia telling the story in giving interviews about this and about Bruce Willis and about him pulling it off. And she said one of the things that struck her and the other cast members was how relentlessly he was working out and in shape. I don't know if you ever heard this, Jay Betzel. So much so that apparently Willis had a personal trainer and had weights, had freelance free weights, barbells, bench press bar with weights on it, and those kind of things readily available right off set, right where he was shooting. And he was constantly getting workouts in while they were on downtime. They would take 30 minutes or an hour to reload something, do something again. And Willis is doing arm curls and bench presses. And she said it was one of the crazier things because he would still be in costume. Because remember his costume in the movie, he's got the undershirt on, the tank top. He's got no shoes on. He wasn't putting shoes on. And he's still there doing bench presses and curls in his costume. I remember her telling us the story that he was that concerned with his physique, his physical fitness. He did a lot of his own stunts in these Die Hard movies, that he was working out with a personal trainer at times, like off to the side while they were shooting these different scenes of the movie. She was struck by that, about how fanatical he was about working out. How about that?
Well, and you know, you mentioned he was kind of wearing the undershirt the whole movie, and I guess they would call it an athletic shirt. I'm not really sure.
I would just
call it an undershirt. Anyways, it was donated to the Smithsonian back in 2007.
You're kidding me.
This movie is such a big deal.
Now, have you been to the Smithsonian in your life?
I have never been.
I have been twice. I went as a elementary age kid. This is longer ago than I want to admit it, and even before Die Hard was made. And I went again as an adult about 12 years ago, and I must have missed the Die Hard undershirt. It's at the Smithsonian?
Yeah, there's an athletic shirt, a poster from the original film, a badge, and the original script.
How and why?
From Live Free or Die Hard are all in it. It's just, they put it next to some stuff with Indiana Jones and Rocky Balboa, and it's just part of the National Museum of American History. That's how big of a deal this movie is and how like, quintessential it was to that time.
I love it. All right. Any other trivia, any other factoids, anything else that we need in closing?
A couple of fun little facts. We talked behind the scenes earlier. We mentioned Joel Silver had made this, the producer. I want to throw out the cinematographer was Jan de Bont, who went on to direct Speed and Twister.
Right, right.
Which is a pretty big deal. He also, I believe, was a cinematographer on another. We've seen that Basic Instinct.
Yeah.
So there's a little Jan de Bont love. And the director of this movie was John McTiernan. You familiar with his work?
I don't know. Keep going. What else would McTiernan do?
Before Die Hard, he made Predator.
Yep.
Following Die Hard, he made The Hunt for Red October. How's that for a three-film run?
I like that. I like that.
Then he hit a little rut later. He made Medicine Man, Last Action Hero, and then had a little bit of trouble with the law. But he did have a good little run from 87 to 90.
87 to 90, he was red hot, and it sounds like a triple feature like on AMC right now on regular cable to have those three movies just line them up.
We were talking box office earlier. For the year of 1988, Die Hard finished number 7. We kind of like to play this towards the end of every show. Do you think you can pick any of the ones that finished ahead
of it? All right, so 1988, I'm trying to think of what else was in the theaters. Now, was Rain Man in the theaters at that point, or is that too soon?
Rain Man was number one.
Wow, I got the – and honest to God, fans of We've Seen That, I do not have the list that Jay has in front of me. I took a guess, and now I'm about to prove that I don't have the list in front of me because I got that one. And I'm trying to think – in and around my senior year of high school, I would have seen Bull Durham, I think, in 1988. Would I be right? Is that in the top 10?
Bull Durham was number 18.
18, not in the top 10. Let me think. What other comedy, what other dramatic one would any of the Batmans? Was Batman out in 88?
That would be 89.
89 the next year. I'm trying to remember in and around my high school graduation, at what I would have seen in the theater in and around there, and I can't. Okay, you got to give me credit. I came up with at least Bull Durham, and
anyone who's listened to our previous shows know you never get any of these. So that's definitely.
And I don't. And
good.
I obviously do not have the list in front of me, or I would be much smarter right now in coming up with something else. Give me some more.
I always bring these on you. We also number one was Rain Man. Number two, Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Okay.
Number three, Coming to America.
With
Eddie Murphy.
Okay. Yes.
Number four, Big, starring Tom Hanks. Number five, Twins, with Danny DeVito, Arnold Schwarzenegger,
like
and the great Kelly Preston.
Yep.
Number six was Crocodile Dundee, which was at $109 million. So at $109 million.
Okay.
Correct. It topped Die Hard, which was number seven. Just following Die Hard, wrapping at the top ten, we have the original Naked Gun, which beat Cocktail by 500,000. Cocktail's number nine. And then wrapping at the top 10, we have Beetlejuice at number 10.
How about that? All right.
A little trip down memory lane there for our
19. That's good. From the year that I graduated from Henry B. Plan High School in Tampa, Florida, before heading off to college later that year at the former Memphis State University. 1988, you would have been middle school? What would you have been?
I was 10 when I saw Die Hard.
God almighty. I still can't get over from earlier in our conversation how that conversation went in the Betzel household about allowing you to go see this movie and that it's okay and not that big a deal with all the violence and all the different stuff.
You know, he might have just been looking for an excuse to go see it again. I don't know. But
maybe.
It's one of those I'll never forget.
It worked out for you. And you now can do the math and figure out how much younger Jay Betzel is than T.J. Reeves on We've Seen That. All right, so what else in closing here on Die Hard? We definitely approve of this. I'm sure it will be on more than once, probably a bunch on regular cable and elsewhere in and around the Christmas holidays, the holiday time. Just because of the themes, plural, the movie, not just an action thriller with some comedy mixed in, but it's also set around Christmas. It works.
Absolutely. And let me ask you this before we say goodbye to everyone. What do you think about the Die Hard sequels?
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of two, and I'm a fan. I know that Paul wasn't that big of a fan of the rest of them. I'm a big fan of three with Samuel L., and I actually like four because I'm a fan of Timothy Oliphant from Justified, the television series on FX, playing Raylan Givens, which if we go completely off the beaten path, we might have to do something about that. And we've seen that. That was a great series for 4 or 5 years where he's playing a deputy U.S. Marshal. Oliphant's the bad guy in Live Free or Die Hard, the fourth one. I wasn't that big into the fifth one by that time, but I'm a fan of the sequel. I'm a fan of the series of the movies. I'm a Bruce Willis fan. I'm in the bag for him on these movies, for John McClane.
When I first saw Die Hard 2, I was really kind of disappointed because I didn't think it was nearly as good as the first one, but it grew on me over the years. It was one of those where it's fun to watch now. It's kind of like some good escapist entertainment.
Well, especially, it's 28, 29 years later, so we're revealing spoilers here, especially when the Army guys, including John Amos, speaking of a few of Coming to America and a guy from Good Times, he's playing the Army major, and he and his guys are actually in with the bad guys, and they turn on Bruce Willis and the authorities to try to help the general escape. That was a great plot twist. In the second one.
The fight out on the wing of the plane while it's going. Can't forget that. That's pretty realistic. But yeah, I mean, it's just kind of become a fun movie to watch, you know, over the years. It's just one of those good action movies. Die Hard with a Vengeance was originally written as a sequel for Lethal Weapon, and they ended up kind of switching it up a little bit and making it a Die Hard movie. So the first two have kind of some fun playfulness, and the third one, you know, it's just like Holly's left him, and there's I didn't like the third one very much. It just didn't fit as a Die Hard movie to me. Live Free or Die Hard, I thought, was kind of whatever.
Jeremy Irons didn't make it as Alan Rickman's brother, as Simon Creed.
Simon Says.
And didn't make it? Okay, well.
I just thought it was okay. It's one that I don't really stop down and watch if I see it on. Like I said, Live Free or Die Hard, not even being rated R, to me, that just kind of abandoned everything Die Hard was about. And then A Good Day to Die Hard, you know, was released on Valentine's Day back in 2013. It's almost like it was made just so they could make that a bit and release it on Valentine's
Day. Well, Bruce Willis was looking for a check, and some others were looking for a check. So, all right, Jay Betzel, any closing thoughts here on the 1988 movie Die Hard?
Just, you know, I just love it. It's one of my top tens. If I made a top 10 list, one we recently did, A Few Good Men, that if you haven't heard yet, definitely jump on iTunes or Blog Talk and please go listen and tell us what you think. A Few Good Men would be in there. Die Hard is definitely in my top 10. You know, we're going to keep going down both of our top 10 lists as we do go through this show and keep adding episodes to it. And I'd just like to say for everyone listening, thank you so much. We definitely hear your comments and see your comments, and we appreciate everything you're saying to us. And for those listening, please tell your friends about us. And you can follow us on Facebook.com/We've Seen That, Twitter.com, We've Seen That. You can find our catalog of all of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher.
I love it. I love all of these things. So get in contact with us. Maybe the audience wants us to review Die Hard 2 as a Christmas movie. I know that we're not going to do it for this Christmas season and what we're doing, but maybe down the road they would want us to look at that one with some different actors that are involved. So good enough on Die Hard for now.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
There is the famous Jay. I'm TJ Reeves. We thank you for being with us as we took a look back on the classic, the 1988 movie Die Hard. Our thanks also to Paul Stewart in London, England. And we will talk to you next time on We've Seen That, movies from the 80s, 90s, and more.
This is a Forking Around Town with Tracy Guida Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Anthony is from Time to Eat Right, and the first time I had him on my podcast, we talked about different meal plans and how if you're trying to lose weight, it's all about eating right. So of course, I'm always out eating. So after, I think a month after we recorded for the first time, I went ahead and got on his program, and it was incredible. The first week I lost 7 pounds. I should say 7 pounds of pizza, probably. That's more accurate. So I wanted to kind of ask you, maybe just kind of give a refresher on the eating program and tell me, how can someone who is just indulging during the holidays, like, what do you recommend for them to kind of ease back into getting back on track with their health and weight goals?
Got you. So I'm with Eat Right. We're a meal plan company. We deliver all the way from Orlando to Clearwater, Largo area. We're going into Sarasota, Bradenton right now. We're trying to grow that market. We're doing shipping right now too. We're shipping to a couple customers, so we're growing pretty fast. But as far as like the holidays go, I would say eat what you want, but just do it in moderation. There's no reason to eat all of the stuffing or, you know, the whole pie. Like, you know, have fun, because if not, then what is life, you know, worth living? So everything you can do in moderation, and it's just that you don't have to eat bad the whole day. Maybe one of those meals you're having a holiday dinner, but you know, you don't have to eat bad the whole entire day. And then after the holidays, you know, get back in the regimen. It's not really hard. You guys can't call it, like, no one can call it a diet. It has to be called a lifestyle. It has to be something you want to live.
Forking Around Town with Tracy Guida can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.